Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. Harvey now a Category 1. The fiercest hurricane to hit the U.S. in more than a decade has been downgraded to a Category 1 storm. But by early Saturday, it had already dumped more than 9 inches of rain on some parts of coastal Texas. No deaths were immediately confirmed in the hours after Harvey's arrival, but officials noted emergency crews couldn't get out in many places due to the high winds. The U.S. National Hurricane Center is still calling it a life-threatening storm. This is Corpus Christi resident Mike Brotherton.
It's a constant howl out there. You hear the wind, you don't really hear the rain, even though the rain's going on. But, you know, the wind's definitely going. You can hear the boards on the house shaking.
A worst-case scenario is that a hurricane could hug the coast for days and stay strong enough to remain a tropical storm. The eye of Hurricane Harvey has made landfall along the coastline of the U.S. state of Texas. Iraqi forces say they have recaptured most of the northwestern Iraqi city of Talifar from Islamic State, including its center, and raised the flag atop of its Ottoman-era citadel. Officials have said they hope to establish total control of Talifar by Eid al-Adha, the Muslim holiday which starts in Iraq on September 2nd. The United States is using new sanctions to forbid any dealings in Venezuelan debt or equity. It is Washington's latest move to pressure the repressive movement of President Nicolas Maduro. U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster told reporters the sanctions are meant to demonstrate that the U.S. will not allow an illegitimate dictatorship to take hold in the Western Hemisphere.
We will continue to work with our friends and partners in the international community to support the Venezuelan people until their rights and democracy are fully restored.
This is VOA News. The way Bana Umar tells it, VOA helped convince him to leave Boko Haram. Until the night of August the 18th, Umar was a fighter for the Islamist radical group, living at a camp in the vast Zambeza forest in northeastern Nigeria. When asked if what Boko Haram does is good and right, Bana Umar says it is not, because the group attacks people mercilessly and unjustly, and in his view, manipulates Islam to its own violent ends. Umar says he heard promises over the radio from the Nigerian Chief of Army Staff, General Tukur Buratai, that defectors from Boko Haram would be welcome, not punished. And he heard how Boko Haram's deadly ambushes and suicide bombings were received in the outside world. According to Umar, he says many listen to radio stations like BBC and VOA. He said, I listened to these radio stations frequently, and I realized that all our activities were evil. We killed, we stole, but what we are doing is not religion. Finally, I got fed up with the group. Umar is now in the Borno State capital of Maiduguri after fleeing the Boko Haram camp. His comments, translated from Hausa, provide insight into how the militants recruit and retain fighters and are managing to survive in the face of a multinational offensive. A former prime minister of Thailand has fled to Dubai, according to senior members of her political party. Reuters' Grace Lee reports.
Thailand's former prime minister Yingluck Shinawat has fled to Dubai. That's according to senior members of her party, who say the ousted leader left the country last week. Shinawat was a no-show at the Supreme Court on Friday, where she faced up to 10 years in prison in a negligence ruling. A judge says she asked for sick leave, blaming an ear problem. But sources tell Reuters that Shinawat flew via Singapore to Dubai to join her brother, former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat, who's also avoiding a 2008 jail sentence for corruption and lives in self-imposed exile. Police say they have no record of Yingluck leaving the country. They've issued an arrest warrant and immigration officials are on the lookout. Hundreds of her supporters rallied outside the courthouse on Friday, where Yingluck was due to hear her fate for negligence over a rice subsidy scheme, which was meant to solve rural poverty, but ultimately cost the country around $8 billion.
That's Reuters' Grace Lee reporting. Relatives and elders protesting the death of 10 Somali civilians allegedly killed in a raid by Somali and U.S. troops say the bodies of the victims will not be buried until the perpetrators apologize. Holding a news conference after the meeting in Mogadishu on Saturday, more than 300 Somali community leaders and relatives of the dead accused the Somali troops and the USA of killing civilians. Joe Palca reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
When the president was away, everybody prayed, irrespective of party. So it was not a partisan prayer that was prayed for his recovery.
The Nigerian president, Muhammadu Buhari, meets both ruling and opposition party leaders Friday.
We are not repatriating them because they are not comfortable. It is because they have responded to the interests of their president that Burundi is now safe.
The Tanzanian government urges the United Nations Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, to repatriate Burundian refugees.
It isn't it true that people from different parties in Malawi are joining the Malawi Congress Party and the party is gaining ground every day?
And the Malawian main opposition party says it remains confident of victory ahead of the next general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Nigerian president, Muhammadu Buhari, met with leaders from his ruling All Progressives Congress, or APC, party and the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, in the capital Abuja Friday. The meeting, President Buhari said, was to signify the country's unity. The president adds that being in opposition does not mean hostility or antagonism, because he says democracy, which Nigeria practices, recognizes a need to opposition that is vibrant but responsible. Meanwhile, leaders of the opposition PDP said they would give the president a run for his money by keeping him on his toes. For more about the meeting, I reach Femi Adesina, a spokesman for President Muhammadu Buhari in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Well, it was a goodwill visit from the two main political parties, the leadership of the political parties. When the president was away, everybody prayed, irrespective of parties. So it was not a partisan prayer that was prayed for his recovery. Therefore, when he needed to meet with leadership of the parties yesterday, he met with them together.
What did they discuss?
Yeah, they just, the national chairman of the All Progressives Congress spoke on behalf of his party, while the caretaker chairman of the PDP spoke on behalf of his party. And what the APC chairman said was they were glad to receive the president back. He used that opportunity to also thank everybody that stood with him in prayer. Then the caretaker committee chairman of PDP spoke in the same vein. He said though they were opposition, they didn't think it was wrong to be praying for the president while he was away. So they also prayed for his recovery and well-being.
So far, how is the president feeling since his return from abroad and plunging right back to work?
From the best of my knowledge, he is faring very well, very well. Since he came back, I've seen him every day, and he keeps getting better by the day.
He recently signed a lot of documents and telling state government officials to straight ahead go ahead and implement those that he signed recently.
Well, it's immediately. As an immediate, because he said it at the signing that they should swing into action and make sure those things became practical. So it's immediate. Don't forget that most of these treaties had been agreed to things. For instance, Abu Dhabi was in January last year that we visited the place. So those four agreements with UAE had been entered into since January last year, but they needed to be perfected by officials on both sides. So now that everything has been perfected, now you have the ratification.
What about the fight against corruption? Because some Nigerians are saying that it appears to have waned and that the people who allegedly have stolen public funds are still going around with no confiscation of their property or prosecution thereof.
That will not be quite correct, because things that have happened in recent time do not back up that hypothesis. There has been a lot of seizures and forfeitures and confiscations. So that will not be quite true.
Femi Adesina is a spokesman for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He spoke with me from Abuja. The Tanzanian government is urging the United Nations Refugee Agency, or UNHCR, to repatriate Burundian refugees who the administration says want to return home. Home Affairs Minister Mwigulu Nchemba said over 8,000 refugees have registered for the voluntary repatriation. Over 240,000 Burundians are currently sheltering in Tanzania after fleeing the recent deadly political violence in their country. Meanwhile, Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza has urged the refugees to return home after reassuring them that their country is now safe. For the latest development about the Burundian refugees, I reached the Tanzanian Home Affairs Minister Mwigulu Nchemba in the commercial capital Dar es Salaam.
We are not repatriating them because they are not comfortable. It is because they have responded to the interests of their president that Burundi is now safe, and their president requested them to get back to their homes, get back to their motherland. And they responded that by registering themselves. And it was only an arrangement by UNHCR and other departments responsible to arrange for their repatriation with dignity. Then, after they noticed that there is a delay for their repatriation, they started riots and the like. So I was just emphasizing to UNHCR that we need not to have these riots. They are going back home. It is in the provision of the international standards for refugees caring that once the refugees demand to be repatriated back home, they are supposed to be attended with urgency. So that was the basis of the statement of the government.
Mr. Nchemba, so it's not a matter of the Tanzanian government getting tired of the refugees in your country?
Nobody is forced to register, and others have registered more than three times. They registered and they were saying, this is the third time we are registering and we are not yet given the attention to go back. Why are you detaining us here? It's no longer a matter of being refugees. We are like detainees because we want to go back. You are not doing that one. So that one is not the force of the government. The time I was getting out of the camp, they were singing, bring the cars, we need to go back to our place.
Have you heard any response from the UNHCR that could facilitate their traveling back to Burundi?
Yeah, I've ordered them and they have already got the response. They will be having a tripartite meeting on Saturday in Dar es Salaam. The UNHCR, our department in the ministry and the government of Burundi to sort the arrangement. But I believe in 7 days we'll have something in place for the exercise to commence. They were asking my ministry to give them additional police to deal with the riots. Then I said we need not to bring police officers to deal with these riots. What we need is to organize for them to go. How will you bring police officers to deal with people who are willingly asking to go back to their homes?
Some people are saying that it's because the government of Tanzania suspended registration and naturalization of thousands of Burundian refugees. This is acting as a catalyst for them to demand that they be sent home. Do you think those criticisms are justified?
If that were the reason, then the one who were registering could have been those who are not refugees. Maybe those who are not registered was supposed to be the one to be going back. Actually, they could not have demanded even registration. These who are registering are the one who has been given the refugee status. And those who are given naturalization are those who have no even places in their motherland because they have stayed for over 40 years. Others are more than my age, you know. So that was not the reason. The reason is that Burundi is safe. These people are ordinary people. They love their motherland. It's only they were not certain with the environment, but the president assured them that the land is safe, no more uncertainties. So that is why they are responding. They, others, I interviewed them, they were saying even they need to go ahead of the season because they are farmers. They need to go ahead of the season. They need to go for farming, you know.
Mwigulu Nchemba is the Tanzania Home Affairs Minister. He spoke with me from Dar es Salaam. The main opposition Malawian Congress Party, or MCP, says it is registering more members ahead of the next general election. The party says the MCP is getting stronger by the day, placing the group in a position to wrestle power from incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika. But supporters of the ruling Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, say the party will be retained in power. Deputy Secretary General and spokesperson for the opposition MCP, Eisenhower Mkaka, told me earlier that the party looks strong after making significant gains in the ruling party's strongholds.
Oh yeah, it is indeed true that people from different parties in Malawi are joining the Malawi Congress Party month, and the party is gaining ground every day, going to regions which originally the party did not have support and stuff like that. And at the moment, we can boast of support from across the country, which is phenomenal, something that was not there before.
What makes your party special? What makes it attractive to Malawian politicians to run away from their political party or defect?
You know, ever since, since 1994, when we introduced a multi-party democracy or politics in Malawi, what we've learned is the transformational leadership that has got a vision, leadership that relates or wants to meet the needs of the people on the ground. And Malawi Congress Party, through its change in 2013, just before the 2014 general elections, brought in that transformational leadership. I think the problem in the 2013-2014 period, it was like the change in leadership came just too close to the general elections, and people did not appreciate the kind of leadership that was ushered in. It is just now that people are beginning to realize that the current leadership in Malawi Congress Party has got a solid vision for the country. The current leadership has got integrity, and the current leadership means well for this country. The problem that Malawi has had is that we've had leaders portraying themselves as wolves in sheepskin. But then people have actually realized that my Congress Party has that leadership that the nation requires, that the nation needs, if it is to indeed transform from its current status.
What do you say to supporters of the ruling party who say Professor Peter Arthur Mutharika, the incumbent president, is too strong for the MCP to pose any significant threat to him and his party in next year's election?
No. That is not true, and that is only a rhetoric. Because the truth on the ground is that Malawi Congress Party is much stronger, and Dr. Lazarus Chakwera is much stronger than the incumbent, Professor Peter Mutharika. Actually, we've broken the regional boundaries. We've actually gone to their base, the area that they were relying on, and we've managed to get popular support from their base. And this is actually phenomenal. It hasn't been like this ever since we changed to a multi-party democracy and stuff like that.
The supporters of the ruling party are telling me that the MCP planted the story in the local media just to say people are joining them, and that it is not true. It's just a publicity stunt.
No. I think they are trying to run away from the truth because there is evidence. We've got names of people joining the party, and no one can say that this is just a public stunt. There is evidence that we can produce of people joining the party, and this is happening almost daily, on a daily basis. And just to show you how strong our party is, as I said, there is a district in the southern region, which is the base of the ruling party. And there is a constituency which fell vacant due to death of its member of parliament. As I'm talking, the ruling party is failing to find a suitable candidate to stand for them right in their base. But we are very confident that we are going to get that seat, and that will be an indicator of what will happen in 2019. When I say that we are gaining ground every day, these are the things that we are talking about.
Eisenhower Mkaka is the Deputy Secretary General and spokesperson for the main opposition, Malawian Congress Party. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Festus Mohai, the head of the South Sudanese Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, admits very little has been achieved in the 2 years since the agreement between the government and the opposition was signed. Mohai says fighting between the warring parties has escalated in the Upper Nile region in the past 2 months. He blames government forces for the stepped-up fighting. For VOA, Waki Simon Wudu reports from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
Festus Mohai held a JEMEC plenary meeting in Juba with the transitional government of national unity ministers, diplomats, and civil society activists. He acknowledged there has been no meaningful progress on implementing the 2015 peace deal due to a continuous cycle of violence, displacement, and deprivation of humanitarian support over the past year, which has led to untold misery.
The security situation in the former Upper Nile State has worsened due to the recent offensive operations by forces of the SPLA in government against the SPLA in opposition Riek Machar faction in Matiang and Pagak.
The peace deal was supposed to end the fighting and unify the country, but Mohai says the country is still far from achieving peace or stability. He says since fighting flared up in Juba between government forces and soldiers loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar in July last year, JEMEC has been soaked by the continuous fighting and the rapid deterioration of South Sudan's security, economy, and humanitarian conditions. Mohai says there have been gross human rights abuses, including indiscriminate killings, rape, and the destruction of property across the country. And he says the number of South Sudanese who are severely food insecure continues to rise.
6 million people, half of the entire population, are now severely food insecure. And the continuous displacement from the Equatorial region, the breadbasket of South Sudan, might further increase future food insecurity as cultivation is disrupted.
The UN Refugee Agency says at least 4 million people have been displaced, 2 million internally displaced, and the other 2 million have sought refuge in neighboring countries. Mohai accuses the government of continuing to deny the ceasefire transitional security arrangements monitoring mechanism or CTSAM access to conflict areas to do their job, investigate ceasefire violations.
We demand the total cessation of violence around the country and a commitment by all parties and groups to pursue a political path to reconciling their differences. We further urge all parties to the peace agreement to facilitate access to CTSAM to conduct their work.
Both the SPLM in government and SPLM-IO, led by First Vice President Taban Dengai, have repeatedly denied they are violating terms of the peace agreement. Michael Makwe is South Sudan's information minister and government spokesperson.
If we go down to follow the provisions of the agreement, point by point, you will find that we have crossed most of the lines.
The transitional government accuses the international community of imposing some sections of the peace agreement, such as the power-sharing ratios and the redeployment of forces outside of the capital, Juba. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
In the past week, nearly half a dozen schools in the two English-speaking Cameroonian regions have been burned to the ground. Local media say it is the latest sign of deepening tensions as the ongoing strike in the English-speaking regions enters its 10th month. Residents say there's need for a self-defense militia to combat the continued arson. This after parents in Bamenda said it was no longer safe for them to return their children to school after the Baptist Comprehensive High School was set ablaze on August 13. For analysis of the current situation in the English-speaking part of Cameroon, Harmony Bobka, president of the Northwest Lawyers Association, joins me live here in the studios. Hello, Harmony.
Hello, Peter.
So what happened? Are your folks burning down schools now?
I hope, what do you mean by my folks are Southern Cameroonians?
English-speaking Cameroonians. Are you burning down your schools?
No, I was insisting.
Just to make the government feel bad?
Not at all.
Why?
The government.
What's happening?
The government has instituted an undeclared state of emergency in Southern Cameroon. That is the Southwest and Northwest regions. And it is an old tactic of this government that has been in power for more than 34 years. They would come and cause atrocities because their case theory in campaigning against us in the international community is to construct us as terrorists. So they sponsor people to burn down the schools and then they turn around and blame it on us.
But supporters of the government are saying that this was a case where people in the English-speaking areas, agitators they call them, are using social media platforms, including Facebook, to create confusion, create disaffection, create disunity, create instability. The government is mandated by the Constitution to protect life and property.
In fact, when government gags communication and social media is there free, it is the only access that an oppressed people have to communicate amongst themselves. And the truth about it is this. Cameroon government, the government of the Republic of Cameroon has already demonstrated before by shutting down internet that they do not want the international community to know the truth of the atrocities that government is carrying out in Southern Cameroon. And it is under pressure from the international community that this internet was reinstalled. And after it was reinstalled, our people have continuously been reporting about what is going on within our territory, even though there is still a high level insensitivity of the international community towards that. And the point...
But why would they even grant you that? Because welders in the English-speaking Cameroon areas, the government proves that they are now manufacturing weapons to attack the security agents in your part of the country.
That is such a big lie, because the welders are trained essentially because government does not afford the citizens sufficient security in our own area in particular. So most of these welders train to make iron protectors so that windows and doors, and there is no a proof of the fact that these people are manufacturing local Dane guns. But the government has decided to use the fact that this is one of the areas of employment that our depraved people in Southern Cameroon have been forced to send their children to train, because people would not do without the products from such artisans. And the production of arms, it's a false story that the government constructs to deepen its argument that we are terrorists. Take, for example, there was a case I was handling in the military tribunal where they were trying some civilians that they worked together with a metalworks fellow in Bamenda to be producing arms, which was false. Recently, the government declared that they found an arms cache in Mbengui, still in the Northwest region, with sophisticated military weapons.
But people who claim they are Ambazonians have been calling and agitating and calling for violence if the government will not negotiate. Isn't it part of the process to create instability?
No. The thing is this. These Ambazonians, Southern Cameroonians or Ambazonians, they have not called for violence. What they have said, and this must be very clear, They have asked for self-defense, that you have your whistles. If your brother, your neighbor is arrested, you start blowing your whistle to alert. So the people, self-defense here is...
Hold your thought, Harmony. Yes. We'll go for a short break. When we come back, we'll continue. Harmony Bobka is the president of the Cameroonian Northwest Lawyers Association. We'll be right back. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But before we get to the music, Harmony, let's come back to you. We were talking about the political crisis in the English-speaking part of Cameroon. What is the prospect of your struggle at the moment?
We are winning, and we are winning big.
How?
Because this government has established beyond doubt that it's a lying government, it's a failed government. And all they had been doing in the last 34 years is exploiting the mineral resources in southern Cameroon.
But it's the central government. What do you expect it to do? It's supposed to...
The central government over who? That's the question. Because as on the 30th of September, the eve of independence of southern Cameroon, as projected by the United Nations, we were denied our independence through a conspiracy of Ahidjo's government, the British and the French, because the British ambassador to then newly independent Cameroon handed the sovereignty of southern Cameroon that was supposed to crystallize on the 1st of October.
But your critics are saying that you were complicit because there were no agitations to demand your independence.
When a thief enters your house armed and, you know, gives you orders and you have to choose between bullets being put in your mouth and being quiet and surviving and fighting tomorrow, what do you do? Which is the smartest decision to take? It's to save your life at that moment. Foncha, as prime minister and head of government, was present at Tiko Airport, but the British ambassador, mischievously, in pursuit of their agreement with the French establishment, handed over the sovereignty to Ahidjo, who was a stranger to southern Cameroon. And after that, Ahidjo overran the whole territory of southern Cameroon with their soldiers. He renamed southern Cameroon West Cameroon without a constitutional basis, given that the constitutional talks in Fumban in July before that September had failed, or at best had been suspended because there was no conclusion arrived at. Meanwhile, it had been projected during the negotiation in the run-up to the Fumban talks after the plebiscite and after the signing of Resolution 1608 Roman 15 on the 21st of April 1961, was that they were going to establish a federation of two states of equal status. This has never happened.
Now let me come to you. You recently left Cameroon saying that the government was targeting you. However, your critics are saying that you confidently walked through the airport, took the plane, and came to the U.S., and that you have been planted by the government to disrupt their struggle in the English-speaking part of the country, and that why are you here when you are leading a bar association there who are fighting for their so-called either federalism or possibly independence?
You know, in a battle, I don't mean armed battle, even in a battle where it is the psychology that you are using, one of the things that this government is adept in is to infiltrate the circle of the southern Cameroonians and harvest people from there to blackmail us. There are still some southern Cameroonians who have been bought over, like those who are in parliament, those who are holding ministerial positions. They are being used against us.
Those in parliament were voted for by the people in the English-speaking areas.
Of course not, because the elections in Cameroon for the 30 years from 1987 that I returned from Nigeria and established in Cameroon up to today have never had a free and fair election. I have been an election observer, an independent election observer. The results are known before time. And even when the people vote, they are moderated by the...
So are you saying the former chairman of ELECAM, Fonka Azu, was complicit in undermining the integrity of the elections that were organized recently?
Of course.
President Paul Biya won?
Of course. Funkam Azu taught me when I went to do postgraduate diploma in Yaounde. He lobbied me to join ELECAM, and I told him, no, you people are fake.
So under what circumstances did you arrive here in the U.S.?
The truth about it is that I was tipped off that if the gendarmes or the police or the army don't get me, they were going to simulate an armed robbery attack in my house. I was told this by a security officer who was sympathetic. And I had to trek through the forest and use little canoes through rivers to smuggle myself into Nigeria without passing through any border check on the Cameroon side or the Nigerian side. And I have my passport right here with me. The people who are fanning the story that I left Yaounde through the airport with all the comfort and support of the government, they need to see the pages of my passport that I flew out from Murtala Mohammed Airport without having passed through any exit point of Cameroon.
Briefly before we go, some people are calling for the southern Cameroonians or the English-speaking Cameroonians to go to the UN and press your case, since you said the UN let you down ahead of your independence. What is the status of that?
Well, we
are you going to do that?
Of course. We are planning to have a massive demonstration during the next session of the General Assembly.
In September.
We are ready to spend a week there and protest peacefully to make our point. And we are also setting up teams to lobby the various delegations in the United Nations to make sure that the agenda item that has bluntly mentioned self-determination could be articulated in our favor, so that the Southern Cameroon self-determination issue, articulated as a right to independence that we have never enjoyed, given that Britain, France, and Ahidjo compromise our independence, will be brought to the table, and when they discuss it and take it over to the Security Council, that would be the first case where the United Nations would have scored the protection of a people's right to self-determination without sending the blue berets there. And for one important thing I need to underscore here is that there is a political economic undercurrent that is affecting the determination of the right to self-determination of Southern Cameroonians. But we are saying we are ready to discuss with all foreign partners proper agreements for doing business. So people who are frightened that when once we get independent, we are going to chase them away are mistaken. We are ready to do business with every person who comes with the interests of Southern Cameroon.
If you're calling for self-determination, invariably, you're also calling for undermining the territorial integrity of your country, Cameroon, which is treasonous, by the way.
No. They cannot establish a case of treason. The self-determination here is grounded on the fact that while the United Nations had envisioned the establishment of a two-state federation in Cameroon, that never took place. Ahidjo and his government and the French establishment, with the complicity of the British government, ran faster than their shadow, and they never established a proper federal constitution. On that account, if we lost the access to independence on the 30th of October by a proper constitutional foundation, we are now still a British trust territory or protected persons, and it is incumbent on the United Nations to execute the trusteeship agreement as affects the Southern Cameroonians by getting Britain to finish its assignment there. And I can assure you, if it is a referendum, it does not have to involve the people of the Republic of Cameroon.
Well, we have to cut it there. We might have to return to this subject another time. That was Harmony Bobcat,
okay. The
president of the Cameroonian Northwest Lawyers Association. He joined us live here in the studios. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Splendid again, oh.
Luciano Records, baby. The way the love they go, baby, you killing me slow. I don't know. See my ass. Where the love they go? Baby, you killing me slow. I don't know where to go. I don't know what to do. Baby, I love you so. I cannot let you go. Young, you been killing me slowly. Making me feel like I'm holy. Girl, I'm loving you every day. Don't go bless you, amen. Bless you, amen.
Mama, baby. kasoro, manyaka kichochoro, mikongo wendomboro.
Liamba now.
Siona kikasoro, manyaka kichochoro, mikongo wendomboro.
Oh, Tell me who rock, who sell out the stars. You tell me who flop, who cop the blue drop, who star rocks. Yeah, but I don't know. Baby, you are my bum, yo. Once you come along, man, yo. Bend down, come and do what you.
When the time is right, my brother, yeah. Deli pressing. Deli pressing. Do them know they deli pressing. When your eyes go bare, deli pressing. Hey, my people, oh, the way you lay your bed now, so you go. Hey. Any wonder?
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the unlucky man's hope prevented him from committing suicide. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Famine Early Warning Systems Network, or FuseNet, a U.S. government-funded provider of information and analysis on food insecurity, is signaling that the hunger and nutrition situation in southeastern Ethiopia is deteriorating, with numerous households in the drought-ridden Somali regional state already experiencing severe food insecurity. Likewise in Kenya, Although the situation is not as dire, insufficient March to May rainfall has left people living in the country's arid and semi-arid regions at risk of crisis-level food insecurity in the near future. In 2011, the Horn of Africa suffered one of the worst droughts on record. The next few years saw subpar rainfall, which means that the hardest-hit regions did not have the chance to recover, either for growing grain or replenishing pasturage. Then came the 2015-2016 season and the abnormally warm El Niño phase of the global weather pattern. As a result, the most fragile regions in the arid Horn of Africa once again saw the deterioration of agricultural and livestock production, rising food prices, and a future wrought with hunger, malnutrition, and resulting diseases. Today, 7.8 million Ethiopians are suffering acute food insecurity, as are 2.6 million Kenyans. That is why the United States announced in early August that it will deliver more than $169 million worth of humanitarian aid for Ethiopia and Kenya. In doing so, the United States is scaling up emergency food assistance. The funds will provide such necessities as specialized nutrition supplies to treat malnourished children, safe drinking water, and essential health services. In Ethiopia, this assistance will provide food aid for about 3 million people. In addition to aid for Kenyans affected by the drought, the United States is also providing support for refugees in Kenya who have fled drought and conflict in their own countries. It is not a famine, but it is rising up to the levels of getting close to famine, said Matt Nims, acting director of Food for Peace at the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID. That is why we want to act now, so that we're not into that stage.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.